I'm Clay Scott, and this is a special half-hour edition of Mountain West Voices. It was 150 years ago that Congress passed the first Homestead Act. The homesteading era was relatively short-lived, but it had a huge impact on the face of Montana and the West and the nation. This is a complicated story with a lot of players, the government and the railroad companies and the native peoples who in many cases had recently inhabited and used the lands that were open to homesteading. On the part of the homesteaders, it's a story of heartache and poverty and widespread failure and unbearable loneliness. But it's also a story of bravery and triumph and of innovation and perseverance and downright stubbornness, as well as the exhilaration that comes with a fresh start in life. Prior to the passage of the Homestead Act, Abraham Lincoln argued that government should serve to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial burdens from all shoulders, and to give everyone an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. For tens of thousands of people who poured into Montana, that turned out to be the case. The little town of Westby is in northeastern Montana on the North Dakota border. Until recently, when the town's empty houses filled up with oil field workers, it was a sleepy place of about 150 souls. Immigrant homesteaders from Denmark established Westby in the early 1900s, along with Norwegians, ethnic Germans from Russia, and other groups. The town was within North Dakota until the border was redrawn, and it became part of Montana in 1914. That also happens to be the year Alice Whitmire was born to Danish parents. On the warm July day I happened to pass through Westby, Alice's worldly possessions were being auctioned off because she was moving to a rest home in Williston, North Dakota. The entire town had turned out, along with farmers and ranchers from miles away in Montana and North Dakota and Saskatchewan. They'd come to bid, but mostly they'd come to pay their respects to someone who'd been part of their community for nearly a century and who shared the same homestead heritage.
$25, $30, $25, $30, $25, $30, $25, $30, $10, $15, $15, $10, $15, $10, $15. Choice by the bottle. Give me $5 choice to start them. $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7, $5, $7,
expression as she sat in the shade, watching her possessions disappear one by one. These were items she wouldn't need in the rest home. A single-shot .22 caliber rifle, an antique German chamber pot, a fox pelt, a jar of marbles. None of these things were especially valuable in themselves, but taken together, they seemed to paint a picture of the life of a Danish-American homesteader who'd put down roots, braved the bleak and nasty winters, the years of economic uncertainty, and, like the men and women in cowboy hats and baseball caps waggling their fingers at the auctioneer, had persevered.
Selling choice by the jar on the marbles. 25, $30, 25, $30, 25, what the $30, 25, 30, now 25, what the $30, 10, 15, 15, 10, 15, 10, 15, 10.
The family of Alice Whitmire, born Alice Madsen, was part of the largest single agricultural migration in North American history. Many of these people were indeed the beneficiaries of the unfettered start and fair chance Lincoln envisioned. They were mostly penniless but hardworking folk, American-born or immigrants, freed slaves and single women, some with farm experience, many with none. The Homestead Act created an unparalleled opportunity for people to reinvent themselves. It gave land, 160 acres of it later expanded to 320, to many people who might otherwise have been landless. It gave a source of income and pride of ownership to those who might otherwise have been without them. And at a time when women did not yet have the vote, it gave single women an unprecedented chance to establish their own farms and take charge of their own lives. Homesteading occurred in many U.S. states, but its impact was greatest in the northern Great Plains, especially in the early 1900s. In Montana, the homesteading boom created towns and communities almost literally overnight. Novelist Ivan Doig grew up near his family's homestead in Marr County, Montana. He uses words like saga and heroic when he talks about the homestead era.
Between 1905 and 1920, some 300,000 people established 80,000 new farms in what they saw as one big vacant lot, the state of Montana. Well, you think about that prairie as a vast tabletop, these tiny figurines scattered around it by tens of thousands. And, you know, and what are they? They're sodbusters and honyockers and greenhorns and school marms and unmarried sisters or aunts or daughters. And, you know, they're out there with their shanties and their breaking plows and their Model T Fords. And there they all are on that 30 million acre table of earth. And we know, but they don't, that sooner or later, as they teeter at the edge of that economically and weather-tilted table, you know, some will jump and some will fall and some are pushed.
There was one factor in particular that helped attract the tens of thousands of would-be homesteaders to Montana in the early 1900s. It was in the interest of the railroad companies to populate the state with farmers and with villages and towns spaced a few miles apart along the main train lines. To that end, the railways produced some extraordinary promotional material. A pamphlet, for example, put out by the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway depicts a fit young yeoman farmer in knee-high leather boots with a fine brace of spirited horses plowing a furrow across a map of eastern Montana, with the Milwaukee line stretching all the way to Seattle and Tacoma. As the plowshare cuts into the earth, instead of clods of dirt, gold coins fly. Another pamphlet begins, "There's not another state in North America where a day's work or a dollar spent in agricultural enterprise will bring such large returns amid living conditions which are so uniquely delightful. We enjoy the tonic of the air, the variety of the landscape, the warm rains of June when rain is most needed, the cloudless days of harvest, the crisp, dry air of winter, mellowed by the kiss of the mild Chinook winds from the Pacific, the happy diversion from toil which a trip to the mountains affords, towns and cities newly built, new faces on the street, something moving, stirring, starting and going somewhere, and always toward achievement, success." It's not hard to understand why people were seduced by all of this, including the grandparents of Sylvia Waters in Teton County. They emigrated from Germany to Minnesota, where they only stayed a few years before the lure of free land farther west became irresistible.
So it was just getting too crowded there, and the homesteading opened up. And they were very good at advertising the beautiful, wonderful rolling green hills. Lush. You know what I mean?
And they fell for it.
And back then, when you came on the train with the few things that you owned and a couple little kids, you couldn't just up and leave. You know, it was pretty much impossible. You know, you didn't have the transportation. And some of the wives, I'm sure, thought, but what were they going to do? You know, but yet they made it. They were tough. And they ended up making a community that they all loved and, you know, cherished and whatnot.
The community Sylvia is referring to is the Beck community. Today, it doesn't exist. I met Sylvia and her husband Gary at the Beck community's tiny, austere cemetery on her grandfather's homestead. It was a windy, 95-degree morning without a bug or a bird stirring, and as we wandered over the parched grass and looked at the gravestones with their simple inscriptions, some of them in German, I imagined trying to scratch a living from the earth in this desiccated country. I wondered if the warm rains of June came every year as promised in the pamphlet, and if the kiss of the mild Chinook winds made up for the frequent gales that come howling off this part of the Rocky Mountain front. Gary and Sylvia confirmed what I had thought, that this district, the place where their families had chosen to begin a new life, is completely dry. To get water, folks here had to travel about 9 miles to a place called Cleve.
People came here with their wooden water wagons pulled by horses and would haul their water because there are no wells over here. This is a natural spring here. And it's still there. As you can see how green it is up there. This was the town of Cleve. Right here. There was the elevator and a lumber yard and community center and grocery stores and school.
As Sylvia talked, it took a bit of effort to imagine the bustling community she was describing. All I saw before me were thick weeds by the railroad tracks, with here and there some stone foundations still visible, and bits of rusted iron and broken glass. In fact, nearly all the formerly thriving homestead communities she and Gary pointed out as we drove, the Beck community, Cleve, Cordova, are today just names that exist on the map or in the memory of people like the Waters. Often, as I travel around Montana, I notice abandoned homestead dwellings. Usually, they've all but disintegrated back into the earth, with only a couple of rose or lilac bushes to remind you that they were ever there. In Marr County, by the time Ivan Doig was a boy, many of the homesteaders had already moved on.
When I was a kid there, around Ringling and White Sulphur Springs, we could still see all the places, as we called them. Every homestead was called a place. You know, there'd be the Vinton place here and the so-and-so place there, and so on. It was the most visible kind of history. And so I think the fact that it's part of so many of us, that helps account for the strength, you know, the mythologizing in some ways, but otherwise it's just the human memory, I think, of so many Montanans. There was a powerful feeling, though, you know, for a kid to realize, you know, here are these empty houses. Look at this. Why are they empty? Look what's left, and so forth. I had a very powerful experience once with my dad. I must have been no more than 8 or 9 years old, and he was, my dad was a haymaker, a haying contractor. He would hire his own crews and, you know, put up hay for ranchers. And he was on a ranch not far from the Doig homestead, and a part broke on a dump rake. They were still haying with horses back then. And my dad remembered, well, there was an old dump rake back at the homestead. And so he and I got in the pickup and went over there to get this part off. And so we pulled down into the 16 country and to the old homestead where my dad and his five brothers and a sister grew up. And here is the log homestead house standing there. Amid the weeds and so forth, and my dad broke down crying. And that's the first time I'd ever seen that happen in him. And, you know, it took me many, many years to understand the emotional force that hit him of seeing what had been his past standing there, in essence, hollowed out and gone.
Montana's homestead boom had such a huge and lasting impact on the state, and yet came and went so quickly that many of the descendants of those early settlers are still trying to make sense of their own tumultuous history. Tim Schaff is a high school history teacher in Roundup, and over the years he's done a phenomenal amount of research with his students, collecting oral histories up and down the Musselshell River Valley. His grandparents were Volgadeutsch, ethnic Germans from Russia, who settled in the Musselshell in the early 1900s. Many of the homesteaders in the area moved on after a short time, but the Schaffs managed to piece together enough land to make a go of it with sheep and, later, cattle. Their ranch, south of Levina, is in an area that's good grazing land, but completely unsuited for the grain that the immigrants thought they'd be able to grow. Tim Schaff is convinced that the government knew that this was not good farmland at the same time as they, along with the railroads, were trying to attract homesteaders to the area. In his research, he dug up a report by the U.S. Forest Service that seems to confirm this.
Then it goes on to say, basically, that it's their conclusion that this should always be remain grazing land and not ever be open to homesteading, which turns out they knew what they were talking about.
Based on what?
Based on the precipitation and the difference in rainfall at the higher elevations and then down towards the Musselshell River here, south of the Snowies.
And this is a Forest Service
report? Forest Service report from 1906.
So before the big wave.
Before the big wave of homesteading, yeah. They didn't think farming of any kind would be a good idea for small operators at all in this report.
And were they right?
They were dead on right. When you read the homestead law, They would give you 160 acres if you could stick it out for a period of 5 years, but there was a point where you could leave and work other places for 3 months or a half a year, and I think that probably should have given these homesteaders a clue that it was going to be a little tougher than just making it on the land that the government would quote-unquote give you for free. There was nothing free about it. You were going to end up earning every acre and square inch of that land that you were on through blood, sweat, and in some cases, tears.
The morning after meeting Tim, I decided to visit the site of his family's original homestead. Driving west along the Musselshell, I turned at Cushman, a place that appears on the map but is no longer a town, and headed south several miles on a dirt road toward Belmont, yet another formerly thriving community of 250 people that's now just a name and a dwindling memory. I met Tim's father, Ned, at the ranch where he's lived all his life.
See, my dad's family, they left Russia because of the Bolsheviks, and he used to talk about how they were so scared at the evenings when these people would come into the villages and threaten them and whatnot. And that, you know, I was too young to really question him all about it, but I just remember some of the stories he used to tell, you know, about how frightened they were and why they came over.
The Schaff family lived a pretty frugal and austere life. They depended on credit from the grocery store in Belmont to get by. Each family member got a pair of shoes every year, and on Sundays before church, Ned's father had to staple the toes shut where they'd worked loose. As a kid, he says, he didn't think of his family as being poor, but he also remembers the frequent occurrence of families disappearing from the community overnight because they couldn't handle the economic uncertainty. In particular, he says, he realizes now how hard the life was on women, like his mother.
Dad, I didn't know at the time, but he was sick, evidently. We kept going, and he died when I was 12 years old. That just left the three of us here with our mother. You don't think it at the time, but she was an amazing woman. I think a lot about it now. But, how lonesome she must have been. I just don't know how to describe it. She had to be awful strong to hold it all together.
Ned's mother was not alone in the hardship she endured. Ivan Doig told me he believed the homesteading movement was built on the spunk of women. And this is the way Gordon McCumber remembers the homestead women of his Teton County childhood.
Life on the farm was just pure drudgery, and it wasn't the good old days. I don't give a damn what they say. They think about the good times sitting around the table with the family, but it was hard work, 14, 16 hours a day. A farm woman, whenever you saw a farm woman, she had a 5-gallon bucket of something in both hands, milk or slop or coal or ashes, and it was just plain damn drudgery.
There were tens of thousands of women among Montana's homesteaders. The wording of the 1862 Homestead Act was gender neutral and specified only that the person filing for a homestead claim must be the head of a family and 21 years of age. Many thousands of women filed claims in Montana and homesteaded successfully. Sarah Carter is a professor of history at the University of Alberta in Edmonton and the author of A Field of One's Own, a book about Montana women homesteaders. I asked her what she found most striking about her research.
The feeling that they should leave a record behind, that so many felt they ought to leave a record behind of what they did. And they must have had a sense that they were doing something that was breaking out of the mold of what were expectations of femininity at that time.
Some of the women came to Montana to escape abusive spouses, says Sarah Carter, but by and large, they homesteaded for the same reasons that men did. Like men, they often came out in groups, mothers and daughters or sisters. They might each file a separate homestead claim, but build their houses where the properties adjoined so that they could, in essence, live together. Some of them proved up, some failed, but the very notion of being able to homestead struck a chord with single women across the country. Take Maddie Kramer. She arrived in Malta, Montana with her teenage son and $100, established a successful homestead, and wrote a glowing testimonial about it in the Great Northern Bulletin. The hundreds of letters she received are revealing.
My dear Mrs. Kramer, being much interested in a homestead in Montana, and upon reading your testimony, I write you in regard to the country. First, I shall speak of myself. I am a single lady, 22 years old. For 5 years, I have been a successful school teacher and hold a first-grade certificate. I am a graduate.
Dear Mrs. Kramer, have seen your testimonial in the Montana Circular, and as I am a lone woman also, am writing to you. I have been unexpectedly thrown on my own resources and thought a claim would be a good thing, as so many write so very favorably.
My dear Madame, your letter of October 1st, addressed to Mr. E.C. Leedy, St. Paul, Minnesota, and published in the Great Northern Bulletin, has been read by me with great interest, and I am taking this privilege of writing to you, asking for some more information regarding your part of Montana. Could a lady with her son of 22 succeed in homesteading there on a capital of, say, $1,000? Though neither of us are farmers, we are fully acquainted with ranch life and desire to undertake it. Would March 1st be a good time to locate there?
Kind lady, Mrs. Mattie Kramer, I am just awful anxious to marry some sweet, loving lady. For me, a good, sweet, loving, and fine, and jolly sweet wife you seem to be, a good woman. I am honest, but I am a poor man. I am a good hand to work. I take care of stock. I would like to be your husband and help you take care of everything.
Kind friend, I read of your success in Montana, and as I am thinking of taking up a claim, I will write you for information. I want to know about the soil near you. Is it very productive? How far north would one have to go to take a claim? Are the winters severe? Are the snowstorms
bad? Dear madam, I want to take up a homestead claim in Montana next spring, but my family cannot be convinced that a lone-lorn damsel can establish her lone-lorn self on a claim way in Montana and accomplish anything. I am 29 years old, without a chick or child or cent to my name. I believe I can borrow the money for a start and pay out by the end of 3 years. I am attracted to the territory around Big Sandy for no special reason except that I know the two people in Hill County and thought it would help me to fight homesickness to be within a few hours of somebody who knows me. Now I would like to impose on your good nature enough to ask you to write me some facts to help me convince my parents and older sisters and brother that I don't need a man to manage in order to work up to making final proof on those blessed acres. I'm convinced myself, but need a little outside help to convince them, and believe a letter from you would help. Thanking you for a reply, I am very truly Miss Grace W. Stebbins.
Many of the women who wrote to Mattie Kramer, along with thousands of other single women, eventually did come to Montana and did make a go of homesteading. Some of them were successful, but few, if any, achieved great economic success. In fact, not many of the homesteaders did, male or female. But as Ivan Doig says, that was never the point of the experiment in the first place.
I feel that I don't know if privileged is the word, but lucky, perhaps. On the other hand, the economic conditions in Montana were very much in my mind. I was well aware, without being able to put it into the words I can now, that not only myself, but my parents and my grandparents, we were all part of the Lariat proletariat, which had been economically deprived and taken advantage of, ever since we lit into the West. We were casualties of the American Civil War of incorporation, as the big companies, as the big economic forces, sopped up the homesteads, turned them into big ranches, turned them into dude ranches, turned them into ski resorts ultimately. We're left to do the chores.
Staying on the homestead didn't make sense for everybody. In Teton County, Gordon McCumber weighed the back-breaking work against the potential economic rewards and opted out of the farm life. For a while, at least.
And I thought if I ever get off this farm, I'm never coming back except on the 4th of July and Christmas, maybe. The Anaconda Copper Company was hiring, and they'd laid their men off during the Depression, and they liked farm kids that knew how to work. And I got in there, and I got on a job that paid me more in a week than farm labor paid in a month. And I had a hell of a good time for a couple of years. And one night we were sitting there, and an old Italian says, "You damn young fools are going to be wore out old drunks before you're old enough to vote. You'd be smart, you'd save your money and start buying some land." Pretty good advice, and so I did. and I decided that I wanted to be a farmer. I made a decision that I wanted back on the farm.
As you travel around Montana, the legacy of homesteading is apparent everywhere. You can see it in the way communities are spaced out in even intervals along the High Line or along the Musselshell or Yellowstone Valleys. You can see it in the pattern of non-Indian ownership of some of Montana's reservations. And you can see it in the homestead shacks still standing around the state and in the much greater number that have been dismantled or have all but crumbled back into the earth. The collective restlessness that afflicted Montana's homesteaders in the first place propelled most of them onwards. Some left their farms to settle in towns and cities in Montana, but many thousands kept moving west and didn't stop until they'd arrived in California or Oregon or Washington. But that makes the stories of the ones who remained all the more remarkable. And while many of the early homesteaders were misled about the Montana winters and the average amount of rain and the gold coins they had hoped to harvest, many more did survive the droughts and the fickle markets and did master the dry land techniques that enabled them to farm successfully in many parts of the state. For the most part, the farms in these areas had to become much larger than the original 160 or 320 acres. But driving through the Golden Triangle, looking out over fields of dryland wheat stretching mile after mile, it's easy to think of the unfettered start and fair chance given to the immigrants who arrived here by train from Minnesota or Ohio or Russia or Norway, found a piece of land to their liking, rolled up their sleeves, and got to work. You've been listening to A Fair Chance, a special edition of Mountain West Voices. Our series is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Special thanks to Ken Robison at the Overholser Historical Research Center in Fort Benton, and to Sarah Carter for permission to read the Maddie Kramer letters from her book, A Field of One's Own. This program was sponsored by the Montana Preservation Alliance, with support from the Steele Reese Foundation, the Montana History Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. To see historical photos and to listen to and download dozens of stories from the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestvoices.org. I'm Clay Scott.